The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
As we head into hour two of our three-hour tour here today, it is a delight to bring back to the airwaves of Phoenix one of my favorite thinkers, writers, and teachers, Christopher Flannery. Chris Flannery, among other things, is a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, editor at the Claremont Review of Books, and now runs the American Story podcast. I was telling you just before the top of the hour break, he has a great piece up at the American Mind, americanmind.org. on the party of 1776. Really good piece we're going to unfold with you all together. Chris Flannery, welcome back.
Seth, thank you very much. Really glad to be here.
Really glad you're here. Among other things, you're a teacher, and you start off with a story about a student on your first day of class. I'll let you tell the story. Tell us what happened.
Well, it was really funny. So this is a class that was going to study Plato's Republic for a whole semester. And of course, I was eagerly looking forward to that. And I think that that is the greatest book ever written on the subject of justice. Mm-hmm. And famously, the central character in the book, Socrates, never satisfies himself that he understands what justice is adequately. And so the conversation had to continue. And so this sophomore student comes into class. I hadn't met her before. We became very good friends later. She comes into class the first day, and she says, "Can I make an announcement to the class?" And I say, "Sure, what is it?" She says, "Well, there's a social justice rally this afternoon, and I would like to encourage people to come." And so it was very funny. She wouldn't have known yet why it was funny, but here we were in a class whose whole purpose was to try to study together a very challenging question of what justice is. And this 19-year-old started the class by urging her classmates to come out and rally to the cause of what she very confidently understood justice to be. So that's how the story
is. Well, it's fantastic. And then you, of course, go into, yes, what you said about Socrates in Plato's Republic and the distillation of justice there. Our certainly American understanding of it in the Federalist Papers, justice is the end of government, the end of civil society. It ever has been and ever will be pursued until it be attained. What you highlighted with your student, Chris, and we'll get to the differences, different views of justice in a moment. What you highlighted with your student in telling that story is something I struggle with here. And my audience who listens closely knows what I'm about to say, which is about 2 weeks ago, I had this caller who was giving me the quote from Isaiah, "Woe unto thee who call good evil and evil good," or confuse good and evil. Mm-hmm. And right, absolutely, all true, of course, as if I needed to validate that, right? But the problem is, we don't all have the same definitions of good and evil. So I started by going back to Lincoln's Sanitary Fair address, where he said the world has never had a good definition of liberty and is just now in need of one. What some call liberty, other call oppression. We have this with justice today, obviously, very clearly, in sharp relief, as you experience with this student or as she experienced with you. You're about to undertake a study of it. She has her own view of it. You know there's something going to be a little different about it by the word, the antecedent to the word justice, social justice.
Yes, social justice.
Right?
Yes.
So we know we're already in trouble. But the students come to you already convinced that they know these things. Makes me wonder why they're students in the first place. I guess to teach the professors in an odd way. But you understand the conundrum, right? We don't have agreement on the common definitions. Isn't this our struggle?
Yeah, it is. And let me just say a little something on behalf of this student that I'm sure you've talked on your show a lot of times about Alan Bloom's Closing of the American Mind.
Oh, yeah, every week at least.
Yeah, yeah. Came out back in 1987 or 8.
Yeah.
And But he, one of the things he said was the great crisis and a terrible thing in a way that he ran into in his classrooms, which you're familiar with, is these students would come into class knowing that there was no truth.
Right.
That is the one thing they knew was true, is that there was no truth. And this is a very, this is the crisis in a way of our time. Now, so I have to say on behalf of this student, as wrongheaded as much as she had to learn, the fact that she came into class with a conviction that it was vitally important to be just, and that she knew something about what that was,
that is a
much more promising beginning of education.
Yes.
And I would say, as I say in the piece, it's natural. People, you know, as the Madison quote that you mentioned, justice is the end of government. People know, without having to philosophize, without having to be told by scientists, they know that you're supposed to be good and not bad.
Right.
So they know that that evil is wrong.
Right.
And now you're right. They have different views of it. But, okay, that's the beginning, in a way, of the most important conversation human beings can have.
And how do you do
it? So,
yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, you start with her confidence, and you say, this is, you mentioned the Republic, and I think Socrates does pretty well, although, as we know, it doesn't end up very well for him.
Athens
put to the death. So you want to do better than that, but...
Or if you want a shorter life, do as well as Socrates,
go down with all guns blazing, and you've done your part.
Right.
But so his conversation starts with an old man, not a young one in this case, but an old man who, without thinking about it and without in any way being a philosopher, he implies by some of the things that he has said that he's confident that justice means, well, being honest and giving people back what belongs to them, which is very sensible and, I would say, true.
Yes.
So it's true, but Socrates, in his typical way, immediately complicates things, and he raises questions about, how do you apply those principles? And they show clearly that, well, actually, it depends. You know, if you have a friend who you have borrowed your friend's car, and your friend is now maybe had a few too many to drink, and he says, "Give me my car keys back," and you say, "No, I know it's your car. I'm not going to give you back." Socrates tries to show that, well, that would be the good thing to do, even though there is this very true principle for ordinary purposes that, of course, you want to give people what belongs to them. And so that's how I would proceed with a student like that. I would say, okay, what are you saying is social justice? And she would say whatever it is. And, of course, one would want to explore eventually, why are you talking about social justice and not just justice and so on? And with any – I mean, this is what classrooms are for. You know, with any luck and with a teacher who's any good, you actually have a conversation, and the student actually opens his or her mind to the question, well, I'm not really sure. I mean, actually, I thought justice was this, but I can see that that's complicated. And – partly you want to show the student that this is the most important inquiry in a way they could ever make. They need to know what is good. We all do. And, you know, and of course we all need to act every day. This is part of the point of my piece. We need to vote. We need to choose friends. We need to go about our business and make decisions. And we do that with convictions about what is right and wrong. And we need to do that. But we have to keep our minds open to be instructed if we find ourselves really being mistaken, you know, being prejudiced and not having thought a thing through well enough. And so a classroom is a place, I think, that's where education takes place, should take place. And students, if they learn, they will be learning the rest of their lives. They'll become, you know, Aristotle, I would say, following yourself, you can't make progress in the study of politics without becoming more virtuous.
Nice.
I think that is Aristotle's principle.
Nice.
And that's my principle of teaching politics. And that is, when the students come in the first day, look, this study of politics, it's about happiness, as you know, and it's about what is good. And you won't be able to get better at politics without becoming a better man or woman.
Right.
Now, that sounds odd to most students when they come in the first day. But I think if you talk extensively for a few weeks, a few months, and a semester, it's true, and it makes perfect sense. And you know, that Madison says justice is the end of government, and it will forever be pursued until liberty is lost in the pursuit of it. He is fully aware that people disagree over the question of justice. Mm-hmm. He's fully aware that unions and nations are destroyed by disputes over that question. He's well aware of that.
Yeah.
And yet, that's part of what you have to do.
And it leads you, as you do, into this differentiation, really, to are we going to appreciate 1776 as a high watermark founding, or are we going to appreciate 1619 as more important, though low watermark founding, for what built this country? Can we do that on the other side of this break?
Sounds great.
I'd love to do it with you. Christopher Flannery is our guest. He of the Claremont Institute, where he's a senior fellow, contributing editor at the Claremont Review of Books, and author of the American Story podcast. You can read his piece at AmericanMind.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delighted to have with us Christopher Flannery. Chris is the author of the American Story podcast, a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, editor at the Claremont Review of Books. We're talking about his recent essay, AmericanMind.org, The Party of 1776. And it flows from a story of understanding and misunderstanding a crucial word in Western civilization, justice. So, Chris, the way you unfold the story and in your essay, there are, I suppose, at their most fundamental basic levels right now, two views of the American founding, the party of 1776 and the view of justice properly understood. And then perhaps, as Nicole Hannah-Jones has done, the view that the founding is 1619. Because of her misunderstanding of what justice is. Is that a fair framing of how you put it? If not, go ahead and you've always been my teacher. You can correct it or take it from there.
Thank you for that. I want to say, first of all, by the way, your program is a great classroom. So thank you for what you're doing. It's really great.
Thank you.
But yeah, Nicole Hannah-Jones, why even talk about this? A couple of months ago, the New York Times, our paper of record, launched a project called the 1619 Project. And Nicole Hannah-Jones is the main writer. She calls herself the architect of that project. And that project explicitly claims, this is the New York Times claiming, that its ambition is to reframe the way Americans understand themselves.
Yeah.
They want to reframe the way Americans understand their country. They want to understand our country as founded in 1619 rather than 1776, and that the significance of 1619 is what really identifies America. And what they mean by that is that in 1619, this was, according to Nicole Hannah-Jones, this is when the first African slaves were bought in Jamestown, I think it was.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is that slavery is what really defines America and not the principle of equality or the anti-slavery principle. And so according to, the reason this is even worth talking about and the reason I wrote that essay is this is a project launched by the New York Times. Nicole Hannah-Jones is a MacArthur Fellow, a genius fellow from the MacArthur Foundation. The Smithsonian Institution collaborates with this project. Corporations are supporting it with great financial resources. And the project aims to influence the curricula in all American schools and how we teach our children about how to think about America. So that's the reason to be concerned with it or to think it's worth talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the critical point is that the 1619 Project understands America to be a racist country. As Nicole Hannah-Jones writes, anti-black racism is in American DNA, according to her. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty close paraphrase. Mm-hmm. And according to the 1619 Project, the Constitution is a pro-slavery document. And according to the 1619 Project, which they want to teach our children in all of our schools, if they possibly can, when those authors wrote that all men are created equal, and when Americans approved that Declaration of Independence in which those famous words were proclaimed, they did not mean to include all black slaves in the phrase all men.
Mm-hmm.
So this curriculum, the 1619 curriculum, has those ingredients in it. And it is absolutely critical to the future of the country that such an understanding of America not be allowed to be taught to our children, to prevail in our politics. And part of my argument is that this I call the sort of, this is the multicultural mantra of the left, more or less. There are many ways of talking about it. But I would say that way of thinking is, again, very roughly speaking, that way of thinking is the way of thinking that largely prevails in the Democratic Party in America. Even though there are many patriotic Democrats who repudiate that, I would say that their party is increasingly dominated by that way of thinking. And again, very roughly speaking, however imperfect all our various Republican candidates may be, very roughly speaking, the opposite of that opinion is what prevails in the Republican Party. So part of my point is to say, in 2020, when Americans vote in 2020, I think one clear thing, way to think, because we can't all, this is part of the argument about, well, you know, Socrates is always uncertain about ultimately what justice is, and we have to make decisions even in the midst of our searching for greater understanding. And in 2020, when you vote, I think a very reasonable thing to do going to the booth is to make sure you are aware that the Democratic Party is essentially the party of 1619 in the way I've just described.
Yeah.
And the Republican Party is essentially the party of 1776. So that's my argument.
Yeah, this would help explain why they choked so much on the campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, right? They don't like the notion of American greatness.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so you hear the mayor of New York or the former mayor of New York saying, when was America ever great?
Right. Cuomo said that, yeah.
And it's astonishing to hear, it's increasingly less astonishing to hear among Democratic politicians those kind of sentiments. But as you well know, in the academy, I mean, that's just the way it is.
But you're absolutely right, yeah, to bring it to practical politics. You have serious presidential contenders in the Democratic Party. In fact, my bet is she's going to be the nominee. But in any event, a serious contender, Elizabeth Warren, as recently as yesterday, giving vent to America being founded on genocide. And of course, you have congressmen standing up every other day talking about our white supremacist founding. It used to be a racist founding, by the way. Now it's white supremacist because I think they've detoxified the word racist. They've now taken it to white supremacist. This is a very serious part of their political agenda, is to reframe America as an evil place.
It's the most essential part.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's the most essential part. You know, we can get into all kinds of very important arguments about tax policy, health care, foreign policy. Those things are critical. They're important.
It's a fundamental transformation of understanding America. Your punishment, Chris, for being so deep and good, is I'm keeping you for another segment. Is that okay?
It'd be a pleasure.
You have to consent to your punishment here.
I believe in that principle.
Okay. And then we will give you early release. We're talking to Chris Flannery from the Claremont Institute, the Party of 1776, his essay at AmericanMind.org. When we come back, we'll talk about how very serious it is when a country loses its history the way the Democrats are asking us to lose it. The modern left is asking us to lose it. And it's interesting. It is the modern left, because while this Governor Cuomo can say this about when was America ever great, I don't think that's something his dad would have ever said. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. We have Chris Flannery from the Claremont Institute with us talking about his essay, The Party of 1776. And before the break, Chris, you had said that more than anything, the modern left, and as it's represented in the Democratic Party, they want to rewrite the founding of America or the understanding of the founding of America. I have become a huge fan of Milan Kundera of late, and I got to read you this quote. I think it says everything. He said, "The first step in liquidating a people is to erase its memory, destroy its books, its culture, its history, then have somebody write new books, manufacture a new culture, invent a new history. Before long, that nation will begin to forget what it is and what it was, and the world around it will forget even faster." That could have been written about today. That's my thought. Do we still have Chris? Did we lose him? We'll double check.
Sorry.
No, there we go.
Sorry, can you hear me?
No, yeah, we got you now. Yeah.
I was affirming all of that and saying that, sorry you didn't hear me.
No, that's all right.
That, Milan Kundera knew what he was talking about. He experienced that himself, as did Alexander Solzhenitsyn back in those bad old days.
Right.
And for us, it's really true, I would say, that, and this is my good friend Tom Klingenstein, chairman of the board of the Claremont Institute, would say this emphatically, that multiculturalism is the communism of our time. It is the slavery of our time. And what he means by that is this way of thinking that dominates the American institutions of higher learning. You can call it identitarian or identity politics. You can call it multiculturalism. You can call it diversity, whatever it is. Everyone recognizes that it has irresistible authority.
Mm-hmm.
And it enforces political correctness, enforces it with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And a critical element of what it is trying to do is to, just as you described, erase American memory and replace it with a new understanding of what this country is. And it is making really terrible progress, which, I mean, it's making a lot of progress, which is really terrible.
Right.
It's so rapidly that it's astonishing, really. You mentioned the, Andrew, the Duke Cuomo, the father and son.
Yeah, right.
And, I mean, that's a generation, but some of these changes happen even more quickly than in a generation.
You bet.
I mean, what is happening with the Democratic Party, the radicalization of the Democratic Party is going, you know, at faster than the speed of light. It's remarkable.
Yes. And, you know, the generational shift, and maybe it's something about what Dennis Prager likes to talk about, the distinction between the liberal and the leftist. Maybe Mario was a liberal, his son is a leftist. Maybe Barbara Jordan was a liberal and Ilhan Omar is a leftist. Remember Barbara Jordan's great speech at the Watergate hearings, how she said she had faith in the Constitution, faith that was complete, whole, and total. It's amazing how some of these very pioneers of the civil rights movement, whether we're talking about someone like Barbara Jordan or, for that matter, Martin Luther King, they loved the founding.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's a very important distinction between, you know, the liberals and the left. And the left is taking over the Democratic Party day by day. And the left, and, you know, for the old-fashioned liberals with whom one could have a reasonable debate about different policy issues and then go have a drink afterward on friendly terms, they were patriotic. They loved the country for the right reasons, more or less. They recognized that this country was dedicated to the principle that all men were created equal, to limited government, to securing the rights of the citizens, and there was agreement on that. And then the issues were, well, okay, how best to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And there you could have lots of disagreements. Now, this is the position of the left, is that America is evil. It is racist. It is sexist. It is elitist. It is an evil imperial regime. And as President Obama, in his very effective rhetoric, said, the fundamental thing is it needs to be transformed.
Mm-hmm. So the task.
And that's, yeah.
Yeah, no. So the task we have, you guys are starting you have started a great project on it, as well as the American mind. The task, I think, for most of us in communications, if we have a microphone, the task is to educate on the things, if I can go back to Plato, on the things we used to know. He ends one of his plays that all education is about things we used to know. What I'd like to do then, Chris, is I'm going to have you back in a few days or next week and talk about where we send people to get the right teaching on this, where we send people.
I'd love to talk to you about that.
Wouldn't that be a great conversation? People are thirsting for
it. And I want to say, too, that's right. There is still possible to get a good education, and it's absolutely necessary and vital.
You want to do it now?
Do you
want to do it now, Chris? I can give you one more segment. If your voice will
hold up. Let me prepare.
Huh? If you got,
take your pick. I mean,
let's do it. If you've got the beer, I've got the time.
I've got
All right. Well, we'll do it. Okay, we'll do it. Then. We'll be right back. Why put off tomorrow what you can do today? Little Charlie Pride for you this afternoon. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delighted to have been able to keep Chris Flannery from the Claremont Institute with us. So how do we teach justice in 1776, excuse me, in the proper understanding of our founding? The understanding Martin Luther King had, the understanding Barbara Jordan had, the understanding most Americans had until the progressives got their hands on it and it moved at warp speed. I don't know what, Chris, the misunderstanding of America at warp speed in the academy about 25, 30 years ago, would you say, or a little further back than that even maybe?
Yeah, you know, and here's the thing. I've been thinking about this.
Yeah.
Look, 100 years ago, Seth, once I remind you of this, you'll remember. 100 years ago, Charles Beard wrote this book called An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution. It was about 107 years ago or something. And that book became the single most widely used book in American high schools.
Uh-huh.
Not that the book was used, but that the teachers were teaching the Beard thesis in their schools for 50 years, even though the argument of the book was fully refuted within a year or even before it was published.
Yeah.
So that was a progressive reinterpretation of the American founding. It was Marxist. It was mistaken. Its facts were wrong. Its analysis was wrong. And it was very influential for the lifetimes of many, many generations of students. That was, you know, that's the progressive reinterpretation of the American Revolution. This one we're talking about right now has set economics aside, and it's really placing race and identity at the center of things, and it's reinterpreting America again. So that's...
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And that started probably about 50 years ago and grew out from there.
It's really with the 60s that comes.
You could find a professor here and there at a major campus that wasn't buying that wrong-headed thesis as far back ago as the late 80s. I think it's practically nil now. But there were a few holdouts,
Yeah, no, I mean, look, there are things, statistics are kind of astonishing in a way. I think I read that, you know, in Washington, D.C., 9 out of 10 voters in the last election voted for whoever it was voting against Trump. I can't even remember.
Yeah, that's right.
And the remaining 9% probably voted for a communist candidate or something like this. I mean, it's really now that's Washington D.C. The American Academy, the institutions of higher learning from Harvard to Yale to Princeton down the line, are more or less like that. It is very, very hard to find a professor who is not professedly really overtly leftist in his or her views. And that's not just numbers. It manifests itself in the administration, in the curriculum, and as you know, in the enforcement of political correctness on campus, that kind of thing. So
let's give them the antidote. So where do we send Americans who are, you know, thirsty for this stuff, right? When David McCullough puts out a book, it does end up becoming a bestseller usually because I think Americans want the good stuff. And
because you know, David McCullough has a recent book called The Pioneer, which is about the Northwest Territory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful story. It's a wonderful American story. And you're exactly right that book simultaneously leapt to the bestseller list and got denounced by professors at Columbia University and other other universities. And that's exactly what's going on. So there's a good one. Read some David
McCullough. And he's probably never voted for a Republican in his life.
And here's the guy. Right, this is a guy, I don't know him personally, although I tried to get him to be a speaker somewhere, and I wasn't able to do that. Because I'm happy for him. He's very busy and very, and he's probably 87 or 88 years old, something like that. But this is, I think, an old-fashioned liberal American patriot.
Right, like a Daniel Boorstin would be considered, or a Samuel Eliot Morrison, or even perhaps, maybe you'd disagree with me on this, I was going to say Commager as well, Henry Steele Commager.
I'm with you there.
And then today
and so
we are blessed.
I would say to people here today, read McCullough. He's great. He's not a political philosopher. He's not going to think through, you know, ultimate themes, but he will tell you the story of America that you can rely on and that shows you. And he means to show you, well, what is admirable, what is beautiful and lovable about, you know, this history that you can understand and see. He's interested in that.
That's
you know, what is noble about the things that your forebears have done? So that's right. You know, so David McCullough's not a bad place to start.
Hillsdale does a great job, Hillsdale does a great job.
Now, okay, if you want to talk about Hillsdale, Hillsdale is great.
Yeah.
And now they can't take everybody. But if you can possibly get your son or daughter to go there, you should send them there.
Right.
You know, they will get a good liberal education and an education that shows them what it is about America that is worthy of the last full measure of devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very few colleges or universities in the country, certainly none that I can think of like Hillsdale that identifies themselves with that. There are some where you can find that, you know, where you can.
Yeah, there's a professor here or there, perhaps. Yeah, there's a Robbie George at Princeton.
There's Robbie George back at Princeton,
you know. Right, there's one or two holdouts.
But readings for citizens, it's not just for students, but for citizens. What about citizens? What do you do? Well, reading David McCullough, great idea. James McPherson, by the way, who is no screaming conservative or anything, he has written some wonderful things on the Civil War, on Abraham Lincoln, on Gettysburg. So if someone is kind of interested in those things, I would just say two things. I'm plugging James McPherson.
Sure.
He wrote a 90-page biography of Lincoln. It's really short. You can read it literally. You can read it in less than 2 hours. You can sit down, sit by your fire, open the book, and read it in 2 hours.
Nice.
I think he doesn't go wrong anywhere.
Good.
I haven't read in a long time. But it's very clearly, crisply written. He hits every major theme in Lincoln's life, and he does it in 90 pages. It's a great service, you know. So and he also, if someone's interested, so that's Lincoln and James McPherson, and he's reliable. And he's not grinding an axe. He's telling you about someone who you find. He himself was an abolitionist, really, in his thinking when he went to grad school, and it took him his whole life to come around to Abraham Lincoln's view, which he did.
Wonderful.
But, you know, so these things are complicated. They can be challenging. And he is a smart guy who came to see that, you know, actually Abraham Lincoln's prudence, his practical wisdom, was greater than that of the abolitionist that he had to contend with.
Right.
And he tells a great story of Lincoln's life in 90 pages.
That's great to know. I did not know that about that. That's wonderful.
I'm going to get you that book.
Okay.
You have that kind of, I'm going to get you. Another thing he did, if you're Gettysburg, I don't know if you visited Gettysburg. I went with my, you know,
seventh grade daughter or something when she went there. Sure.
And I had a great guide and went around there. And James McPherson, God bless him, he has led tours at Gettysburg, many of them.
Wow.
And he wrote a book. I can't remember the name of that book, but James McPherson wrote a book based on his tours of Gettysburg.
Oh,
basically,
wow.
It's one that you can take with you when you walk around there.
Fantastic.
And read it. And he does it with the kind of piety that is proper for that sacred ground. And this is not a
Chris,
you know,
I gotta let you go there on that, but we'll leave it on that high note.
Great talking
to you, Chris Flannery. Speaking of high notes, Tricia Yearwood will take us out. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. If you're feeling run down and don't have the energy you used to, it's likely because you're not taking enough or eating enough fruits and vegetables. It's time to try Balance of Nature's fruits and vegetables in capsule form. Balance of Nature is not like ordinary vitamins that are made with synthetics. It's just natural food in a vegetarian capsule with tens of thousands of vital nutrients from vegetables, fruits, and 100% whole food plants. A daily dose of Balance of Nature has 10 servings of 31 different fruits and vegetables. I took my veggies first, and I just took my fruits, and I got apple and banana and blueberry and cherry and raspberry and papaya and orange and grapefruit and tomato in one easy-to-take dose. Once you start taking Balance of Nature, you'll feel great, as I have. People report that their skin looks better, and they have a lot more energy, as I can also attest to. It's time to improve the quality of your life. Experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. Call or go online now and become a preferred customer, which gives you their best pricing and free shipping, and they'll take an additional 35% off your first order. This is a limited-time offer, so don't wait. Call 800-2468-751 or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code BALANCE. Doug is in Maricopa. Hello, Doug.
How the heck are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I always do great in the late afternoon when we have you guys discussing great subjects.
Oh, thank you, man.
Today is just another day of great conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, I was wondering if I can propose something. I would love to hear you slap me down and tell me I'm incorrect. So tell me where I'm erring in my logic here. But I think we do ourselves a disservice when we let the left define the terms of debate. And even in this, because I think you guys are 100% correct in that our history is not being taught. So I view that as a separate discussion. But the left, what the left is doing when they say we go back to our founding is back in the 1600s, is we are letting them assume that because our founding was not perfect as defined by them, it makes it irrelevant. I would prefer if we say, I will not even discuss this until you totally reject the welfare state, because which was expanded under Roosevelt because of the internment of hundreds of thousands of Japanese in camps, no different than Germany.
All right, hold this thought a minute, Doug. This is a big, big subject you're opening, and I want to do it. So can you just hold through the top of the hour, and we'll come back on it. Defining the narrative of America. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back.